Thank you for listening to this service from Calvary of Albuquerque. It's our hope that this message will help you grow in grace and in the knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
It was Mark Twain who said, "Don't complain about problems that you might have." Ooh, thank you, Lord. Not going to complain about rain that's coming our way. We could use it. He said, don't complain about problems that you may have, because 80% of the people that you tell your problems to don't care. The other 20% think you're finally getting what you have coming to you. Well, the whole group of the children of Israel murmured and complained. I heard about a cowboy. He was driving on a dirt road out in the middle of nowhere in the West in a pickup truck. In the back of the pickup was his dog. And behind the truck, he was towing a trailer with his faithful horse. And as they were on the dirt road, he was driving through the turns and the twists, and he failed to navigate a curve and got into a terrible accident that overturned the truck and the trailer. Well, the highway patrolman came by and he saw that it was a pretty bad accident. And he went over to the horse, being an animal lover himself, and saw that the horse was beyond any kind of medical help and would die naturally. And to put it out of its misery, he took a revolver out of his holster and decided to save the horse from a miserable several hours. And he shot the horse. He walked around the accident and he saw that the dog was whining and had broken several parts of his anatomy. And so he also desired and decided to put the dog out of its misery. Then he walked over to the driver. And he looked down as a policeman ought to and said, "Are you okay?" And the driver, looking up, though he had several broken bones, saw the smoking revolver and said, "I've never felt better in all my life." Well, we started to see a group of people who complained against Moses and the Lord. And we've been outlining this book last week and this week in this manner. The book is divided up into three parts. There is the organization of the camps of Israel. Then there is the disorganization through unbelief and disobedience. And then there is reorganization. So chapters 1 through 13 is the organization. We saw that last time. Chapters 14 through 25 is the disorganization of the children of Israel. We just barely began to touch on that last week. And then beginning in chapter 26 to the end of the book, that is chapter 36, we have the reorganization. Meaning, the first generation all die in the wilderness, and the new generation, their sons and daughters, are the ones that enter the land. Now, do you remember last week when the 12 had been sent out into the promised land to spy out the land? And they came back. 10 of them had a bad report. "Don't go. There's giants. We're dead meat if we try to take this land." Only two of them, Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, said, "God has given us the land. We're well able to take it." Well, the children of Israel listened to whom? The 10, the majority, thinking, well, the majority can't be wrong. And so they sided with the majority, and they did not believe, and they murmured and complained. And they said to Moses, the people of Israel, "We should have died in Egypt. Oh, I wish we would have died there and not even come out to the wilderness." Then a few others said, "I wish we would have just died here in the wilderness." Big mistake. God heard that and basically said, "All right, you'll have your wish." And that entire generation, except for those two men that I mentioned, all will die in the wilderness and never make it to the promised land. So tonight, as we finish out the disorganization and the reorganization, we want to think about the failure and the future. The failure and the future. The failure in the wilderness of the old generation, and that all speaks of death, and they will all die in the wilderness. But then the future in the new land, the new generation that comes in. So chapter 15 is where we begin. And it's wonderful because it begins in hope. Chapter 15 through 29 really is the failure in the wilderness. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you have come into the land that you are to inhabit, which I am giving to you." Boy, that's a wonderful thing to say, isn't it? It's wonderful, you see, because God doesn't say, if you come into the land, but he assures them that they will, even in spite of their complaints, their unbelief, and their failure. When you get into the land, they may not all make it individually, but they will eventually make it corporately as a nation. So not if, but when. It's very encouraging. It reminds me a little bit, and I know I'm lingering long on the first verse. You say, "Skip, at this pace, you'll never make it." Don't worry. But it reminds me a little bit of Peter when he was in prison in Acts chapter 12. Herod the king saw that killing James, this brother of John, pleased some of the people. So he was going to kill Peter the next morning, and he had him in prison. And we find Peter chained between two guards, sleeping in prison. Do you find that odd that a man, the night before he's going to be executed, is getting a good night's sleep, chained between two guards? You know why? Because Jesus Christ had told him something that a lot of us skip over. Remember when Peter was with Jesus at the Sea of Galilee and Jesus said to him, this is John chapter 21, "Peter, when you were young, you girded yourself and you went wherever you want to. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hand," speaking of his crucifixion in Rome, "others will gird you and carry you where you don't want to go." Did you hear what Jesus said? When you are old. So here's Peter a few weeks later in prison, sentenced to die the next day, but he knows he's not going to die because Jesus promised him that he would grow old. So he gets a good night's sleep. So here God is saying to them, when you get into the land, implying, stating, you'll make it. "And you make," verse 3, "an offering by fire to the Lord, a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a vow, or as a free will offering, or in your appointed feasts to make a sweet aroma to the Lord from the herd or the flock." Go down to verse 22 now. "If you sin unintentionally and do not observe all of these commandments which the Lord has spoken to Moses." See, God is giving them provision for their sin. Verse 30. "The person who does anything presumptuously, whether he is native born or a stranger, one that brings reproach on the Lord, he shall be cut off from among his people." So the way of dealing with sin is once again spoken about. Okay. Sin is certainly not a popular concept or subject in our modern era. It's regarded as outdated, medieval, and primitive. And a lot of people will say, well, you're not supposed to feel guilty. Because when you feel guilty over something you've done wrong, all it does is mar your self-esteem. Your self-worth goes down. Now, that's interesting to me because our culture will tolerate sin, no problem. But we won't tolerate the guilt that comes as a result from sin. Our culture has basically declared war on guilt. So if you go to the average psychologist or therapist, they'll say, "Stop blaming yourself. It's not your fault." Well, it might be your fault. And maybe that's the place to begin, to call it what it is, to ask forgiveness for it, to confess it, because the Bible says, "He who conceals his sin will not prosper, but whoever confesses and forsakes them will find mercy." You know, we live in a culture that everybody's the victim. It's the victimization of the Western world. Everybody's the adult child of something. Alcoholic, workaholic, left-handed poker player, whatever. So that we can all say, "I am the way I am, not because of any choice that I've done, but solely and totally it's somebody else's fault." It might be partly somebody else's fault, but there comes a point at which we must all take ownership, and the Lord knows that here. I don't know if you remember the story of Bernard Cummings. It's New York City. He went out and he mugged and beat an elderly New York man out in the streets of the city. In fleeing the scene after beating the old guy up, Bernard Cummings was shot. The result of the shot is he was paralyzed. And he sued the New York Transit Authority for $4.8 million and won. Now, what's wrong with this picture? The old guy that he beat up is still paying doctor bills. By the way, he's a cancer survivor. Still paying doctor bills from the accident. And the guy who did it is a millionaire. So the Lord knew what the real problem was and said, here's how to deal with it. Now, the next four chapters form a block. 16, 17, 18, and 19 deal with the priesthood. The priesthood. Why? Because in chapter 16, there's a problem, and it will all be fixed in these chapters. So these four form a block. Remember, the children of Israel are complaining, and they continue to do so. There's eight different murmurings that are recorded in the book of Numbers, eight of them. Well, in chapter 16, there's a guy by the name of Korah who is in the ministry. And Korah is a prominent Levite. And he, along with 250 other leaders, rebel against Moses' leadership, Moses' authority. By the way, you may just want to write down in your notes this chapter and look at it later. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, because it's the corollary to the book of Numbers. Over and over again in that chapter, Paul will say, don't do what they did in the wilderness. And some of the very stories we're going to mention tonight are talked about in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. One of them is this one. And don't complain like they in the wilderness complained. Now, they complained a lot. It sort of became their national anthem, the whine. And we have here the fifth murmuring, and by the end of the chapter, the sixth murmuring. Verse 1, now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, the sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you take too much upon yourselves. In other words, Moses, you have way too much power for one guy. You take too much upon yourselves. For all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. So why then do you exalt yourself above the assembly of the Lord? Well, what did Moses do? He took the rebels and said, we're going to have a showdown. Verse 23. So the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the congregation saying, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. So you know this is a setup for some big thing God's going to do. The complaining started with the mixed multitude, made its way through the crowds. Now we have a group of prominent leaders rebelling against Moses in the wilderness. I heard of a boy who called his dog, named his new puppy, Uncle Joe. You say, why did he do that? Well, that's what his family asked him. Why are you calling him Uncle Joe? And the little boy said, because he reminds me so much of Uncle Joe. This puppy growls at everything and wants to fight everyone he sees. Uncle Joe. You all know an Uncle Joe. You might be an Uncle Joe. And the Bible would take this kind of behavior in the context of an assembly very seriously. You say, oh, but it's just Old Testament. We don't have to worry about that. Well, these examples are translated into the New Testament. Listen to one verse, the book of Jude, verse 11. Woe to them, those who are fallen away in the congregation, for they have gone the way of Cain, run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. So God says, tell everybody to get way back from the tents of these guys. Then Moses come in and Moses says to them, look, here's the deal. Here's the showdown. Let's have a contest. If Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On, and all these other 250 guys, if they die of natural causes, they just get old and die, then the Lord isn't speaking through me. But if the earth opens up and swallows them alive, then I'm the guy that God sent. So, let's see what happens. Verse 31, it came to pass, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground split apart under them. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the men with Korah with all their goods. So they and all those with them went down alive into the pit. The earth closed over them and they perished from among the assembly. Interesting way to go. You see, this group of 250, their sin was dividing the congregation of Israel. So the fitting judgment of God was to have the earth divide and swallow them up. Paul will say in Galatians, don't be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that also shall he reap. Korah the complainer, but also, I'm going to call him Korah the poser. He's a poser. Meaning, he thought that he could use this opportunity, this wave of complaint, to exalt himself and push himself into higher leadership. He was a Kohathite. He was a Levite. But he wanted to be in the priesthood. He wanted to perform more functions and have a role of more prominent leadership. But he really was a poser because God hadn't called him to that office. God already laid down the callings previous to this. Several years ago, when Merv Griffin was alive and was interviewing people, one of the groups of people one night Merv Griffin was interviewing was a small group of bodybuilders, big muscles, oiled down on his show, standing up there like this. And Merv asked them a very simple, profound question. What do you do with all those muscles? Here was the answer. The guy flexed and went, you can see I have none. Wait a minute. Yeah. And so Merv said, well, that's impressive, but let me ask you that question again. What do you do with all those well-developed muscles? Once again, the answer was a pose. Three times he asked him, answer my question. What do you do with those well-oiled muscles? The pose. They were posers. That's all they did it for. Not to do anything great, not to find accidents and take cars off of people who are in them, just to pose. That's Korah. He was a poser. Chapter 17. The poser's dead. Chapter 17, like chapter 16, God is confirming the priesthood now through Aaron and his son. So this is what he does. God furthers the thing and says, let every one of the tribes of Israel, all 12 tribes, with the name of the father's house, put that on a stick. Take 12 sticks, and for the tribe of Levi, put the name of Aaron on a dry, dead stick. Get these 12 sticks and place them before the ark in the tabernacle. So they did that. Verse 8. Now it came to pass on the next day that Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds that produced blossoms and yielded ripe almonds. This is a resurrection or a picture of it. Something dead comes to life. Aaron is validated. The priesthood is validated through Aaron and his lineage by a dead stick coming to life and being blossoming, bearing forth fruit. Now, in the Ark of the Covenant, and we have the Ark back with us tonight, as you can see, or not the Ark, but a replica of the Ark that's been old and spray painted several times. But in the Ark of the Covenant, underneath this mercy seat, there were three things. One of them is here, the Ten Commandments, or a copy of them, the law. But inside the lid, look, it opens up. I'm not supposed to do that, right? Okay, there was a copy of the law. There was a golden pot with manna in it. And there was Aaron's rod that budded. And these three things, according to Hebrews 9, were kept in the Ark of the Covenant as a memorial throughout the generations of the children of Israel to remind them of those lessons. That God provided bread, the law that was broken, the blood that covered it, and also the fact that Aaron and his sons were called by God to be priests. Now, I just said for fun, of course, this isn't the real Ark of the Covenant. Do you know where the real Ark of the Covenant is? You don't know because nobody knows. There's a lot of guesses, and there's people who claim to know. There's even a church that claims to have it over in Ethiopia. I think there's another one in Egypt, but we don't know where it is. It hasn't been found. It would be an exciting discovery to find the Ark of the Covenant. But I got to tell you, seriously and honestly, I'm glad nobody has discovered the Ark of the Covenant. Because if somebody did, it would turn into another relic that is worshipped. I'm sure that there would be vendors outside the place where the Ark is selling little stone tablets or pieces of the original stone tablets or pieces of Aaron's rod that budded. And even if they sold 10,000 of them and they ran out, they would have the miracle of the perpetuation of Aaron's rod that budded, and they would make a lot of money off of it. So I'm glad it has never been discovered, because people have a tendency to worship such things. Chapters 18 and 19, and again, these are the four chapters that form a block, 16, 17, 18, and 19. Chapters 18 and 19, like chapter 17, confirm the priesthood. In chapter 17, God just plainly says, look, this is whom I've chosen, the tribe of Levi, the house of Aaron, the Levites, and the Levites alone are the ones who are to perform the ministry in the tabernacle. You might be a well-meaning person from the tribe of Issachar or Zebulun or Benjamin, but this is a genetic thing. As we said a few weeks ago, you have to have Levi genes in order to serve in the tabernacle. That is genetics. Okay, chapter 19. Still in that block of four about the priesthood, but chapter 19 details a strange ritual for cleansing those who have become defiled, especially by touching a dead person. Here's the ritual. They were to find a red heifer. You say, what's a red heifer? Well, a heifer is a young female cow who has never given birth. That's a heifer. A red one, that is reddish in hue, a red-colored one. You say, I don't think I've ever seen a red heifer. A red heifer is considered a biological anomaly. According to Jewish tradition, there have only been nine red heifers from the time of Moses to the destruction of the Second Temple. The red heifer was taken, burned, the ashes collected, and then kept for generations because there'd be a lot of ashes. A few of the ashes would be put into a vessel. Running water, spring water, would be put into the vessel. And if somebody was defiled ceremonially, especially by touching a dead corpse, the priest would take a hyssop branch, dip it in the water, and sprinkle the people, and that would cleanse them. It was the cleansing of this red heifer. It is interesting that the oral law, the Mishnah, has several sections, tractates, all about the red heifer. And if you were to go to Israel today, and some of you will when you go in April, check out the Temple Institute. Walk in there and ask them about the red heifer. And they at the Temple Institute will tell you that in the last couple of years, they have discovered two. They have discovered two. That they have declared kosher because they're all about rebuilding the next temple. One has recently been declared as unfit, but there's at least one that they say is declared fit and would serve for a long time in ceremonial cleansing. So they're getting ready in the building of that temple. But what I want you to notice about this is there's overtones throughout this chapter, as well as other chapters. Here's the overtone. It's a theme that runs through the whole five books of Moses. Sacrifice, offering, death of a victim, blood that has to be shed in order to atone for defilement or for sin. Blood must be shed for sin to be cleansed. That concept bothers A lot of people, keep in mind what Paul said, the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. Listen to one statement by a feminist theologian named Dolores Williams. Quote, I don't think we need a theory of atonement at all. I don't think we need folks hanging on crosses and blood dripping and weird stuff like that. Theologian? What kind of theologian is that? Well, not a biblical one. Now, why would she say that? Anybody would say that because they don't realize the reality and the seriousness of inward sin. It's the only reason you'd say something that lame. If you don't realize or believe in the concept of inward sin that people have, they would make that statement. The cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. That's why people have problems with the doctrine of an eternal hell, because most people don't realize that sin could be that bad to warrant that kind of punishment. They don't understand the doctrine of sin and God's holiness. That is the problem. There was a little boy who was washing windows for his mom. In fact, he asked, he volunteered. Mom, can I help you wash windows? She said, sure. Gave him a bucket, sponge. He went outside and scrubbed hard as he could, till his arms were sore. Didn't seem to clean the windows at all. He was frustrated and he said, Mom, what am I doing wrong? And Mom looked and said, why are you wasting all of your time outside? The dirt is all on the inside. What a lot of people do is try to clean the inside, outside of their lives. I'll work on this habit, on this issue, on that problem. The real problem is on the inside. And that's why so much detail in the Bible is given for cleansing, sacrifice, and atonement. Well, that's the failure in the wilderness. Look now with me at chapters 20 and 21. This is the failure on the way to Moab. The failure on the way to Moab. Now, I got to tell you something. Between chapter 19, which I just told you about, we didn't even read any of it, and chapter 20, we believe is a gap of guess how long? 37 years. 37-year gap has transpired. Takes us into chapter 20, which is the seventh murmuring. The chapter begins with death and ends with death. Begins with the death of Miriam, Moses' sister, ends with the death of Aaron. So the bookends of this chapter are death. Verse 1. Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month. And the people stayed at Kadesh. And Miriam died there and was buried there. Miriam was that great lady who, when they crossed over through the Red Sea and the Egyptians watched them, Exodus chapter 15, she's the gal with the tambourine who led the worship. But she also recently, remember last week, led a rebellion against Moses. And she represents this whole generation who's about to die in the wilderness. She dies. Now, it says they were at Kadesh. That's deja vu, man. They were there 37 years ago. I think Moses was going, oh my goodness, deja vu. I was here almost 40 years ago with those 12 spies who I sent out. And they came back, and lo and behold, they had gone in a big circle for over 37 years wandering in the wilderness. Verse 2. There was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron, and the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, if only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. That's pretty harsh. They're thinking of Korah and the 250 that died when the earth swallowed them up. They're going, I wish we would have died with them. I'm thinking Moses going, I do too. Why have you brought up the assembly of the Lord into the wilderness? That we and our animals should die here. And why have you made us come out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink. So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and they fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. 37 years ago, they were there. They wandered, they wandered, they wandered, and they came back to the entrance of the promised land. It will be a total of 40 years that they will wander. How many days did the 12 spies examine the land? 40 days. So you might look at it this way. The 40-year sentence was 1 year for every day that they had spied out the land and brought back a bad report. Deuteronomy chapter 1 will tell us it's only an 11-day trip from Kadesh to the promised land, or from Mount Hor to Kadesh. 37 years later, after the first wanderings, they're there again. Verse 7, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, take the rod, you and Aaron, and beat up the congregation. No, and gather the congregation together. Sorry. No, notice this. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation and their animals. That sounds pretty cool, doesn't it? Okay, Moses, come here. See that rock? Yeah. Go talk to it. Okay. Hey, rock. That's what he was supposed to do. Hey, any of you remember? Well, you'd have to be pretty old to remember this. Remember in 1975, the pet rocks that came out? Okay, here's what's sad. I had one. And I talked to it. I didn't have a pet, and I thought, these are pretty easy to maintain. I come home, and there was the rock smiling at me on my desk. I think I gave it a name and I talked to it. Then I realized this is lame. But then I read this scripture and Moses was told to talk to the rock. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. And he said to them. Now, wait a minute. Moses, don't talk to them. Talk to it. Talk to the rock. So he gets them all together and he says something to them. So you know it's a problem. Hear now, you rebels. Must we bring water for you out of this rock? And Moses lifted his hands and he struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly in the congregation and their animals drank. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron. Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given to them. This was the water of Meribah, means quarrel, strife, or contention, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord, and he was hallowed among them. Think back. Think all the way back to Exodus chapter 17. In the wilderness, not of Zin, but the wilderness of Sin, and they encamped at Rephidim. And there God said to Moses, take your rod and strike the rock. It's the only time God told him to do it. Now he says, don't hit the rock. Don't hit them. Just talk to the rock, and it'll bring forth water. Instead, he talks to them and beats the rock. And God says, you're not going into the promised land. And I know some of you are thinking, that's not fair. I mean, think about poor Moses. 40 years he was being trained for leadership in Egypt. 40 more years in the backside of the Midianite desert. And then almost 40 years, altogether 40 years, of listening to their complaints. Give the guy a break. This is unfair. God didn't let him go in. Why? Number one, plainly, simply, he disobeyed God. He let his emotions get out of control, which led to disobedience. Any emotion that you let get out of control can lead you to disobedience. He just disobeyed. Number two, he failed to misrepresent God, or he failed to represent God correctly. Moses was a representative of God. If you're a representative of the Lord, you need to represent him correctly. God wasn't mad at that point with him. But the way Moses represented God would indicate to the people, man, God's really mad right now. Number three, Moses exalted himself in this situation. Notice what he says. Must we bring water from the rock? Oh, who's we? You have no power to bring water out of a rock, Mo. Right? It's a miracle. Only God can do that. Must we? You get out of here. He exalted himself, took too much on himself in this story. And number four, I'm going to add this because I have a New Testament perspective. He dishonored Christ. Say, what do you mean he dishonored Christ? Well, again, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4, it says, and they all drank from the same spiritual drink from the rock, and the rock that followed them was Christ. Now, he's speaking idiomatically. It's not like a rock was following them, different places. The idea is that idiomatically speaking, analogously speaking, parabolically speaking, the rock was Christ. If Moses would have obeyed God, he would have given a beautiful model of the first and second comings of Christ. At the first coming, Jesus was struck, and out of his death flowed life. The second coming, you don't have to strike him twice. He's going to come again. Now you have a relationship with him. You speak to him. You have fellowship with him. If he would have just spoken after the first smiting years before, it'd be a beautiful picture of the rock that followed them, who was Christ, in the first and second coming. So that's why I say he dishonored Christ. Verse 29, go down to there. This is now the end of the chapter. When all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, so Miriam dies at the beginning, Aaron at the end of the chapter, all the house of Israel mourned for Aaron for 30 days. Grief is normal, and there is such a thing as good grief. Just like there's bad grief. Bad grief is when you stuff it all in, refuse to cry because you're a man. I'll get over it. Leave me alone. I won't deal with it. Or too long, prolonged, never getting over it. But there is good grief where for a period of time you mourn and you're in grief and you allow yourself to do such. In ancient cultures, it was a period of a month, 30 days. They really gave full vent to their emotions and dealing with family issues. Chapter 21 takes us to now the eighth murmuring, which is the last murmuring that is recorded. And by now, Israel had complained and murmured so much, they'd refined the art of griping. They were like Picassos at griping. They were like valued artisans. And they complained against God and Moses again. Chapter 21, verse 5. The people spoke against God and Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread. What worthless bread is that? Yeah, that's a Krispy Kreme donuts. They got sick of it. So the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died. Don't complain against donuts ever again. I'm just kidding. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. So Moses prayed for the people. Boy, they got spiritual really quick, didn't they? Here they're complaining and grumbling against the food and against God and against Moses. And then snakes bite them and they die. And they go, pray, we got to pray. We have to have a prayer meeting. Nothing like a little affliction to get people on their knees. And I don't believe God is cruel. I don't believe God is masochistic. But sometimes I just wonder if I can't hear, even in my own life, when I haven't been seeking the Lord and all of a sudden a period of affliction hits and I'm on my knees, if God's whispering, saying, great to hear from you. It's been a while. David even said, before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now I seek the Lord. So now they're praying. And why does he do this? Why does God send this? It's going to sound weird to some, because he loved them. You remember when you used to spank your kids, or still do? And they said to you, you don't love me. Was that true? No, you spanked them because you did love them. And you were worried at that time, oh, my child, what does he think about me? The issue isn't what he thinks about you when he's 4 or 5 as much as what he will think about you when he's 18, 19, 20 and out of the house because you gave him a loving, disciplined home. God loved them and wanted them to turn back to him. Verse 8, the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, make one, and set it on a pole. And it shall be that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, shall live. So Moses made a bronze serpent, put it on a pole, and so it was. If a serpent had bitten anyone, when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. I imagine some people in the camp of Israel thought, this is stupid. There they are, snake bit them. They're dying. Oh, I'm dying. And somebody goes, hey, look, I just looked at that brass serpent on a pole and I feel better. Just look this way. Look at that brass serpent on a pole. Oh, I don't believe in that hocus pocus stuff. You can't get me to buy that. Yeah, but you're dying. Just look at it. Nah, not me. I'm a rationalist. I'm an empiricist. There's no logical reason for me just to look at a brass snake on a pole that I'm going to be healed. But here's the kicker. It worked. You know why? Because it was a look of faith. It was foolish. By the foolishness of preaching the gospel, people today are saved. It's that simple look of faith that made all of the difference. Why? Well, Jesus will explain it to Nicodemus in John chapter 3, that illustrates his crucifixion. For you see, the pole was a banner pole, like an ancient flag pole, but it had a vertical and a horizontal stay like a cross. That's what banners were put on for the emblems of Israel, that kind of pole. So to have a brass serpent on a cross-like pole was indicative of what would happen when Jesus Christ would come. That's what Jesus said. For as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the Son of Man will be lifted up, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. And that's verse 15, prelude to the most famous verse in all the Bible. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, not a serpent, a son, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. Why a brass serpent? Brass is a metal of judgment. The altar on the outside of the big courtyard for sacrifices was made out of brass. That's where sin was judged. The serpent was a emblem or symbol of Satan, Genesis chapter 3. It was then a symbol of sin being judged on a cross. It's a symbol of 2 Corinthians 5:21. God made him who knew no sin to become sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Look by faith and you'll be saved. Well, just a heads up. Wait a few weeks. Wait till we get to 2 Kings. Wait till you see what Hezekiah does, because they're going to save this brass pole with the serpent for generations. By the time King Hezekiah is there in 2 Kings, they will have been burning incense to this sacred icon like they would if they found the ark. And King Hezekiah broke it into pieces, because people called it Nehushtan and they burned incense to it. Chapters 22 through 25 lead us to a very weird guy, bizarre. His name is Balaam. He's an enigma. He's a puzzle, a puzzlement. He's an enigma, first of all. There's more written about Balaam than about the Virgin Mary in the Bible. There's more in the Bible written about Balaam than any of the apostles. His name is mentioned 59 times in Scripture. And he shows up here for several chapters. I'm going to sum some of them up. Verse 1 of chapter 22. The children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho. Now Balak, the son of Zippor, here's the king now, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. So a king named Balak hires Balaam to do something. Verse 5. He sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor. That's down by the Euphrates, which is near the river, in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth. There's about 3 million of them. And they're settling next to me. Therefore, please come at once and curse this people for me, for they're too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. Boy, was Balak wrong. There's only one person that can fit a description of, and that's God. Whoever God blesses is blessed. Whoever God curses is cursed. God said, I'll bless those who bless you to Israel, and I'll curse those who curse you. What was Balaam? Okay, Balaam was a Baru, B-A-R-U, a Baru, a Mesopotamian Baru, which is an Akkadian word that means he was an oracle priest, a priest who would give out statements or oracles, omens, words from the gods, based upon, like, the entrails of animals. That's one of their practices. They would take out liver out of a dead corpse, and they'd look at it the way it shines and wiggles, and they would make a prediction based on the wiggle of a liver. Seriously. The drops of oil. You know how people, like, read tea leaves, and they see patterns in them? It was sort of like that. They do it with the stars and the planets, etc. So he was a pagan guy, but God somehow supernaturally spoke through him, because God put his words in this prophet's mouth so that nobody could curse Israel and that they would be blessed, because that's God's covenant with them. Verse 21, Balaam rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. God's anger was roused because he went, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. And he was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. I remember as a boy seeing a sitcom on television growing up. It was called Mr. Ed. Some of you remember Mr. Ed? Honestly, raise your hand if you love Mr. Ed. You remember it? Oh, horse is a horse, of course, of course. That's very good. And no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is right. The famous Mr. Ed. Okay, let's go on. Why did I share that? I have no idea. No, I shared that because what you're about to read is the Mr. Ed of the Old Testament. The donkey of Balaam is about to talk. It's a fun story. And I'll tell you what it reminds us of. All of us who speak for the Lord, don't get too prideful. I'm a mighty spokesman of God. Don't get too prideful. If God can use a donkey and speak through a donkey, don't get too puffed up and prideful. Just be thankful that he uses you or I. Verse 23. Now the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and the donkey turned aside out of the way and went into the field. So Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back on the road. That's the first time. Now the second time, they're by a vineyard. There's walls. It's very narrow. Sees the angel of the Lord, the donkey, not Balaam. The donkey turns aside and crushes Balaam's foot. Now the third time, the angel of the Lord stands in a very narrow place. They can't turn around. Verse 27. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. So the Balaam's anger was aroused, and he struck the donkey with his staff. And the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey. And she said to Balaam, here it is. Here's the Mr. Ed. Wilbur, listen. Here it is. Here it is. Here's the donkey speaking. What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times? The donkey asked a very good question. And Balaam said to the donkey, because you've abused me, I wish there were a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you. So the donkey said to Balaam, they're having a conversation. Am I not your donkey in which I have ridden ever since I became yours to this day? Was I ever disposed to do this to you? And he said, no. First of all, I'm impressed that a donkey knows the word disposed. Okay. This is an amazing story. A donkey is talking. What's more amazing is that Balaam talks back to it. He didn't stop and go, wait a minute, donkeys can't talk. Are you Mr. Ed? He didn't do any of that. He has a conversation with him. You know what's even more amazing? We talk to our pets all the time, and they can't talk back to us. Now, I just wanted to throw that in. Look at chapter 22, verse 41. So it was the next day that Balak took Balaam and brought him up. So the end of the story is the donkey takes him finally to King Balak. Balak took Balaam and brought him up to a high place of the high places of Baal, and from there he might observe the extent of the people. The story goes like this. A few different lookout points, the king takes Balaam to look at the children of Israel, pronounce a curse on them. In each of the three occasions, there's beautiful prophecies that God puts in his mouth to bless the children of Israel. So, as he looked down from whatever mountaintop and he saw the camp of Israel, remember what it would look like to him. With all the camps of Israel laid out around the tabernacle, the form of a cross. God had made a covenant with these people. Chapter 23, verse 8. How shall I curse whom God has not cursed? How shall I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? Chapter 24, verse 5. This whole story continues through this chapter. Here's part of the prophecy. How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel. Like the valleys that stretch out, like gardens by the riverside, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. But watch this, chapter 25, verse 1. Now Israel remained in the acacia grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal, false pagan god of Peor, worship there, Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was roused against Israel. It's not until we get to chapter 31, around verse 16, that Moses will tell us what happened. Balaam did not curse the people of Israel, but secretly brought Balak aside and said, look, buddy boy, I can't curse whom God has blessed. But we don't have to curse them. Their God will curse them. Because you see, their God is such a jealous God, he doesn't like idolatry. So if you can get your pretty little ladies to walk through their camp and get these men to have a little affair with them, then they'll bring out their little gods during this little escapade, thus idol worship. Because of that idolatry, God himself will have to judge them. So that was the counsel of Balaam to them. In chapters 26 through 36... we now have the third and final division. Remember, organization, disorganization. This is now reorganization. This is a new generation, and they're preparing to enter into the promised land. So this is the future. We've seen the failure of the old generation that brought death. This is now the future that brings life. Chapter 26, verse 1. It came to pass after the plague... You say, what plague? Well, there's been a lot of them, but this one is the previous chapter. Chapter 25, 24,000 people died in a single day because of sexual immorality with this Baal worship. It came to pass after the plague that the Lord spoke to Moses and Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saying, take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and above by their father's houses, all who are able to go to war in Israel. Kind of like deja vu, kind of like chapter 1. It is. Chapter 1 was the first census taken of the older generation. They'll all die off. 603,550. Fighting men above 20 years of age. Now they recompute with the next generation, and there's 601,730. So there's been a zero population. In fact, there's been a loss of 1,820 in 37, 38 years. That number is given in chapter 26, verse 51, 601,730. So there's been a loss, zero population growth. Chapter 27, we won't read, but it's about inheritance laws. And if your name is Zelophehad, you may want to read this chapter because it has everything to do with the offspring of a guy named Zelophehad who had no sons but had daughters, and a law was formulated because of them. So, chapter 28 through 30 is all of those offerings we've already covered, all those seasonal offerings and sacrifices we covered last week. You say, why are they repeated again? Because it's a new generation, that's why. Old ones dying off. Bring that into remembrance. Chapters 31 through 36 is the land that is apportioned on both sides of the Jordan River. They crossed the Red Sea, went through the wilderness, and crossed the Jordan River to get into the Promised Land. But not everybody did. There were 2.5 tribes that saw how beautiful some parts of the eastern area of the Jordan River were. And they said, can we just stay here? We don't want to really go into the land God promised you guys. We'll stay here on this side. And their tribal names were Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. The other half will go west of the Jordan. Now you have to see the area to appreciate it. The area up by the Golan Heights is still the favorite area of the Bedouin tribes in that area to this day. It's where the oaks grow, the grass grows, there's more rainfall, pistachio orchards grow wild. It's just beautiful and verdant. They didn't want to go any further. So they strike a deal. Look down at verse 5. Let's pick that up. Chapter 32. Go down to chapter 32, verse 5. Therefore they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants as a possession. Do not take us over the Jordan. Now go down to verse 18 of chapter 32. They strike a deal. We will not return to our homes till every one of the children of Israel received his inheritance. We will not inherit with them on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has fallen to us on the eastern side of the Jordan. So they cross over and fight. Then they'll go back. That's the deal. Chapter 33 is all the places they camped. And the beginning point, and the it's a journal. It's the log of all of their encampments, a summary of their routing as they made through the wilderness. Chapter 34, the boundaries of the land are given from the south, west, north, and the east. Look at verse 12 of chapter 34. The border shall go down along the Jordan. It shall end at the Salt Sea. This shall be your land with surrounding boundaries. And Moses commanded the children of Israel, saying, this is the land which you shall inherit by lot, which the Lord has commanded to give to the 9 tribes and to the half tribe. Okay? And so the land is given, the cities are given, including the cities of refuge, the Levitical cities, which ends the book. Okay? So we're done with the book. But wait. Here's the tragedy. It's good we finished the book on time. Here's the tragedy. If you go back and you pencil out all of the land God promised them to inherit, it's about 300,000 square miles of land. Go back to Genesis 15 and other places where the allotment is given, 300,000 square miles. Israel, at their peak of history, only occupied and enjoyed 30,000 square miles of land. So God promised them this, and they enjoyed 1/10 of it. I just wonder if there isn't a corollary with some of us. We're saved. Great. Are you enjoying all of your riches in Christ Jesus in heavenly places? All of the promises, are you grabbing a hold of them? Or are you content with less? I just want to barely make it to heaven. I don't. I want a red carpet entrance. I want to live my life to the full, save as many people as I can, have a lot of fun on the way, do it right. And I think you do too. Charles Spurgeon said this, most Christians, as to the river of experience, are only up to the ankles. Some have waded up to their knees. A few find it breast high, and but a few, and oh, how few, find it a river to swim in, the bottom of which they cannot touch. Now, Moses didn't make it into the land, but he will later. Plant this thought in your mind. You'll read in the Gospels that Jesus appears on a mountain in Israel with Moses and Elijah, talking about the kingdom. He made it in a glorified state. You'll also read about him, I believe, in Revelation chapter 11. One of the two witnesses, because the signs of one of the two witnesses is he calls fire down from heaven. That would be Elijah. Another one has the power to strike the waters and make them blood like Moses, call plagues down from heaven like Moses. And so many believe, self included, that one of the two witnesses in the future tribulation for Israel will be Moses. So, are you wandering or are you walking? I pray that it's the second.
Thank you for listening to this service from Calvary of Albuquerque. If you would like more information about what you've heard in this message or about Calvary of Albuquerque, please visit our website at www.calvaryabq.org. If you have made a decision to follow Christ or would like someone to pray for you, please leave a message with our Prayer Watch line at 505-344-3658. Thank you, and God bless.